Good morning and welcome to the Thursday edition of Times the Brief. I'm Harvey Kojan, and these are the top stories of the day.
At least 400 people were arrested in Venezuela this week, authorities said on Wednesday, as the South American nation grapples with widespread looting and riots amid a crippling economic crisis and the world's highest rate of inflation. Looters swarmed shops in the coastal town of Cumana on Tuesday to seize food and other supplies, with security forces nearly powerless to stop them, Reuters reported. Several unconfirmed deaths were also reported during the violence, but regional governor Luis Acuna insisted that these were unrelated to the looting or arrests. Protests and riots, with people chanting, "We want food," have spread across Venezuela in recent weeks due to severe shortages caused by the recession, Reuters says. Many blame Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro's socialist economic policies for the country's dire situation, with opposition parties calling for a referendum to remove him from office this year. This article posted by Rishi Iyengar.
Islamic militant group Abu Sayyaf in the southern Philippines is threatening to behead two more hostages, a Norwegian man and a Filipino woman, if it does not receive a ransom of 600 million pesos, almost $13 million. The Philippine Daily Inquirer reports that the threat follows the brutal beheadings of two Canadians, Robert Hall and John Ridsdale, after their government did not meet ransom demands. Hall, 68, was killed on Tuesday, and Ridsdale, 68, was killed on April 25th. The two current captives, Norwegian Kjartan Segenstad and Filipina Maritris Flor, were kidnapped alongside the two murdered Canadians on September 21, 2015, from a marina and resort on Samal Island in Davao del Norte province. Founded in the 1990s with Al-Qaeda funding, Abu Sayyaf, meaning bearer of the sword in Arabic, is a radical Islamic group based in the southern Philippines that has pledged allegiance to ISIS. It is notorious for kidnapping and was responsible for a 2004 ferry bombing that killed 116 people. "We will upload a new video soon for our new ultimatum," Abu Rami, the Abu Sayyaf spokesperson, told the Inquirer. "No ransom, another beheading." The Philippines has a no-ransom policy when it comes to dealing with criminal groups, but outgoing President Benigno Aquino said that private negotiators have been in touch with Abu Sayyaf for the Norwegians' return. He has flown to Jolo Island to meet with military and strategize their safe return, AFP reports. He has also reportedly considered imposing martial law on Sulu. "If we pay ransom, it would only worsen the problem and encourage others to engage in kidnapping," he told the local media. "All I can say is the demand has to be met," Sekenstad told the Inquirer by phone on Wednesday morning. "Otherwise, we will be executed." President Aquino, meanwhile, apologized to Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau for the two Canadian deaths on Monday and briefed Norwegian Prime Minister Erna Solberg on Tuesday. According to regional security firm Pacific Strategies and Assessments, Abu Sayyaf currently has 8 hostages. This article posted by Casey Quackenbush. A man who threatened to come back Orlando style at a gay bar in New York City was arrested on Monday night, the day after a gunman's rampage at a gay nightclub in Orlando left 49 dead. "I'm going to shoot this place up and get my 50 just like Orlando, Florida," said Justin Rice, 40, when a bouncer removed him from the Happy Fun Hideaway, a bar in Brooklyn, DNA Info reported. "I'm going to come back Orlando style." On the same night in Manhattan, thousands gathered outside the historic Stonewall Inn for a vigil in honor of the Orlando shooting victims. Rice, who also yelled homophobic slurs and threw a metal bucket at the bouncer, was charged with aggravated harassment, attempted assault, making a terrorist threat, and menacing as a hate crime, according to DNA Info. His bail has been set at $10,000. The best thing you can do to show the world that we believe in love is to continue to support us and all of our queer and artistic communities, The Bar posted on Facebook on Wednesday night, thanking customers for their support and expressing bewilderment at what an odd world we live in. This article posted by Katie Riley. An early report on Zika in Colombia reveals that close to 12,000 pregnant women have the virus. In the report released Wednesday in the New England Journal of Medicine, Colombian researchers and scientists at the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, said that as of April, there were 65,726 cases of Zika reported in Colombia, with double the number of infections in women compared to men. This could be due to the fact that more women may be tested due to the risks of pregnancy. The report also shows that 11,944 pregnant women have been reported to have Zika, with about 1,484 of those women confirmed with specialized laboratory testing. The researchers looked at a group of close to 2,000 of those pregnant women and report that over 90% were infected during their third trimester, and no infants with birth defects have been identified so far in this group. One of the things scientists are hoping to learn from studies like this is why some women with Zika will give birth to babies with microcephaly and others will not. It's suspected that the time of infection during pregnancy has a role, and the fact that the women who were infected later in pregnancy had healthy babies could be telling. This article posted by Alexandra Sifferlin. Officials have recovered the body of the 2-year-old boy who died after being taken by an alligator Tuesday night at a Disney resort in Orlando. At a press conference late Wednesday afternoon, Orange County Sheriff Jerry Demings identified the toddler as Lane Graves, son of Matt and Melissa Graves of Elkhorn, Nebraska. The couple was also vacationing with their 4-year-old child. The toddler had been playing in shallow water on the bank of a man-made lake at Disney's Grand Floridian Resort and Spa. Demings said the 2-year-old boy's body was recovered completely intact around 3:30 p.m. Wednesday by the Sheriff Department's dive team. His body was found in the area of the shore where he was taken, but murky water made it difficult to locate immediately. Nick Wiley, executive director of the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission, said officials removed several alligators from the lake on Wednesday and will work to confirm that the specific alligator involved is among them. "We're going to make certain that we have the alligator that was involved and that we remove it from the lake," Wiley said at the press conference. Disney is now facing questions about whether it provided guests with sufficient warnings about alligators on the beach. While there were no swimming signs by the lake, the signs did not mention alligators. "Disney will look at all of their protocols and signage going forward," Demings said. "As a parent and a grandparent, my heart goes out to the Graves family during this time of devastating loss," Disney CEO Bob Iger said in a statement, according to The Hollywood Reporter. "My thoughts and prayers are with them, and I know everyone at Disney joins me in offering our deepest sympathies." Wiley said Disney routinely identifies and removes alligators that appear to be unafraid of humans, but he did not respond to questions at the press conference about when an alligator was last removed from the lake. "We will take a careful look and really try to learn from whatever happened here," he said. This article posted by Katie Riley. Egypt on Wednesday said that it spotted and obtained images from the wreckage of the Egypt Air plane that crashed into the Mediterranean last month, killing all 66 people on board, according to a statement by the country's investigation committee. The committee said that the vessel John Lethbridge, which was contracted by the Egyptian government to join the search for the plane debris and flight data recorders, had identified several main locations of the wreckage. It added that it obtained images of the wreckage located between the Greek island of Crete and the Egyptian coast. The next step, the committee said, will be drawing a map showing the wreckage location. The 75-meter-long survey vessel is equipped with sonar and other equipment capable of detecting wreckage at depths of up to 6,000 feet. The EgyptAir Airbus A320, en route to Cairo from Paris, had been cruising normally in clear skies on an overnight flight on May 19th. The radar showed that the doomed aircraft turned 90 degrees left, then a full 360 degrees to the right, plummeting from 38,000 feet to 15,000 feet before disappearing at about 10,000 feet. Leaked flight data indicated a sensor detected smoke in a lavatory and a fault in two of the plane's cockpit windows in the final moments of the flight. The cause of the crash still has not been determined. Ships and planes from Egypt, Greece, France, the United States, and other nations have been searching the Mediterranean Sea north of the Egyptian port of Alexandria for the jet's voice and flight data recorders, as well as more bodies and parts of the aircraft. Since the search began, only small pieces of wreckage and human remains have been recovered in an area that has been narrowed down to a 5-kilometer region of the Mediterranean. Egypt's civil aviation minister, Sharif Fati, said he believes terrorism is a more likely explanation than equipment failure or some other catastrophic event. But no hard evidence has emerged on the cause, and no militant group has claimed to have downed the jet. Wednesday's announcement came nearly 2 weeks after the French ship Laplace detected black box signals from the missing plane. Locator pings emitted by flight data and cockpit voice recorders can be picked up from deep underwater. The Laplace is equipped with 3 detectors designed to pick up those signals, which in the case of the Egypt airplane are believed to be at a depth of some 3,000 meters. By comparison, the wreckage of the Titanic is lying at a depth of some 3,800 meters. 10 days later, Egyptian investigators said that time is running out in the search for the black boxes. They said on Sunday that nearly 2 weeks remain before the batteries of the flight's data and cockpit voice recorders expire and they stop emitting signals. If retrieved, the boxes could reveal whether a mechanical fault, a hijacking, or a bomb caused the disaster. The voice recorder should contain a record of the last 30 minutes in the cockpit and is equipped to detect even loud breathing. The data recorder would contain technical information on the engines, wings, and cabin pressure. Investigators hope the black boxes will offer clues as to why there was no distress call. Finding them without the signals is possible, but more difficult. Last October, a Russian airliner crashed in Egypt's Sinai Peninsula shortly after taking off from the Egyptian resort city of Sharm el-Sheikh, killing all 224 people on board. A local affiliate of the Islamic State group claimed responsibility for downing the aircraft just hours after the crash. In November, Russia said an explosive device brought down the aircraft. The two disasters have unsettled authorities at the Cairo airport, where false alarms or bomb threats have caused lengthy delays to flights and at least one cancellation last week. Security has also been considerably tightened at Egypt's 20-plus airports since the Russian plane crash, with passengers now subjected to roughly the same security measures in force at major international airports. This article posted by Maggie Michael for the Associated Press in Cairo. President Obama's Wednesday meeting with the Dalai Lama in Washington ruffled a few feathers in China, around $1.3 billion to be exact, according to China's foreign ministry spokesperson Liu Kang. The 80-year-old exiled Tibetan leader and global icon is seen as a dangerous separatist by Beijing, one that is perceived as a threat to China's sovereignty. During a press briefing on June 14th, Kang said of the upcoming White House meeting, "Under the cloak of religion, the 14th Dalai Lama peddles his political ambitions of dividing China all around the world. We ask all countries and governments not to give him any room to carry out such campaigns, even less risking arousing the firm opposition from the 1.3 billion Chinese people." While it is unknown what was discussed at the White House meeting, which U.S. officials called personal, the Dalai Lama has over the years crossed the globe meeting with a variety of state leaders, billionaires, and celebrities. Speaking to Time in 2014, the Dalai Lama explained that all he wants is compromise with China. "We are not seeking independence," he said. "We are seeking general autonomy." Chinese officials are unconvinced, calling the exiled spiritual leader a wolf in monk's robes who seeks to separate Tibet from China. Beijing says its sovereignty over Tibet goes back centuries, but Tibetans disagree. Beijing has a very narrow view of what the Dalai Lama is, and they see him as someone who wants to split China apart, says William A. Callahan, a professor of international relations at the London School of Economics, LSE. The logic is whenever any foreign leader meets with the Dalai Lama, they are therefore supporting separatism. The same year the People's Liberation Army took control of Tibet in 1950, the Dalai Lama officially became head of state at the age 15. He met Chairman Mao Zedong while negotiating for Tibetan autonomy, but was eventually forced to flee Tibet to northern India with his cabinet in 1959. The antipathy toward the Dalai Lama may have its roots in Chinese grievances that actually have little to do with Tibet. According to Callahan, Beijing's stance on Tibet is tied in with very deep feelings of a century of humiliation, a period in the 19th and 20th centuries where China lost control of its territory to Western and Japanese imperialists. According to this Communist Party founding narrative, that century ended when Mao established the People's Republic of China in 1939. Even though the rest of the world, especially the Western world, views the Dalai Lama as a benign religious and cultural icon, Callahan believes that Chinese officials will continue to regard him as a political figure seeking to undermine their legitimacy. "In a sense, it's a sign of insecurity," says Kerry Brown, professor of Chinese studies and director of the Lao China Institute at King's College in London. "They are uneasy to questions about the rights of their control and are willing to throw diplomatic capital over meetings that are actually of little geopolitical significance, like today's encounter in the White House." Brown notes that in recent years, Western leaders, apart from the U.S., have mostly stopped meeting with the Dalai Lama, largely over fears of negative diplomatic repercussions with Beijing. In 2012, UK Prime Minister David Cameron's meeting with the Dalai Lama was strongly condemned by the Chinese. "They didn't get ministerial visits from China for a year," says Brown. This is the fourth time Obama has hosted the Tibetan Buddhist monk. It is important to note that their meeting was conducted in the MAP room, not the Oval Office, which is traditionally used for meetings with heads of states. Obama also limited the fallout with China by holding the meeting behind closed doors and out of the public eye. China's anger may in part be bluster, but it looks like even America is listening. This article posted by Tara John. One was an American private security guard with a history of domestic violence and no known criminal record. The other was a French ex-convict who had served 2.5 years in prison on a terrorism recruitment charge. But the propaganda arm of ISIS claimed both men, Omar Mateen and Larouassi Abala, as soldiers after they committed murder in their respective countries. The divergent profiles of the people claiming to kill in the name of ISIS underscores how the group embraces a broad spectrum of potential foot soldiers, whether or not they have prior contact with the group or a deep commitment to its ideology. Omar Mateen, the gunman who killed 49 people at a gay club in Orlando on Sunday, falls into the category of attackers acting in ISIS's name without any known operational ties to the group. Other attackers, like Abala, who stabbed 2 police officers to death in their home outside of Paris on Tuesday, follow a more familiar path to jihadi-inspired attack, one that included personal contact with other would-be militants and time served in a Western prison system. As information continues to surface, a more complex picture of Mateen's motivations has emerged. Bar patrons said Mateen had frequented the Pulse nightclub before his attack. His ex-wife says he may, in fact, have even been gay. These descriptions of Mateen as a man who drank alcohol and may have struggled with his sexuality provide an awkward counterpoint to ISIS's efforts to claim the shooter as a soldier of its puritanical caliphate, and the efforts of some in the U.S. to claim that Orlando was an ISIS attack. Nevertheless, ISIS has endorsed both Orlando and the double murder in Paris through their official media arm. There's a good reason for that. ISIS is losing ground in Iraq, Syria, and Libya, and analysts say it's seeking to reverse an image of decline and defeat by claiming spectacular acts of violence, even if the group had little or nothing to do with them. It's just an open casting call for anyone who wants to perpetrate violence, says Clint Watts, a former FBI counterterrorism agent and a fellow at the Foreign Policy Research Institute in Philadelphia. They're desperate for success, but it works when there are people willing to do it. 2 days after the massacre in Orlando, 25-year-old LaRusi Abala stabbed to death an off-duty police captain and his partner, also a police official, at their suburban home in the town of Magnanville, outside of Paris. He then sat down and broadcast a live video on Facebook in which he proclaimed his allegiance with ISIS. The couple's 3-year-old son sat behind him. According to news reports, Abala gestured at the child. "I don't know what to do with him," he said. Like Mateen, Abala had also announced his support for ISIS at the last possible moment, speaking into his phone at 8:52 p.m. local time, shortly before he was killed by police special forces responding to the attack. Abala's message appears to have been very specific. He said he was responding to an appeal for attacks issued in May by ISIS spokesman Abu Muhammad al-Adnani. Abala was one of a group of men jailed in 2013 as part of a plot to send militant recruits to Pakistan. At the time of his trial, he was quoted in Le Monde saying that his interest in militancy began when he was unemployed and lacking direction in life. "I needed recognition," he said. He began to spend time with a group of men who spoke of jihad constantly. His former girlfriend told French radio that he became even more religious following his release from prison. Abala's story is similar to past French attackers, including those who attacked the offices of the satirical magazine Charlie Hebdo in January 2015. He was an alienated man, jailed at a young age and hardened in prison. He was well known to French police, but that doesn't mean they were able to keep close track of him. Hundreds of young French citizens have traveled to Syria and Iraq to join militant groups, including ISIS, and many have returned. "France has a jihadi problem," says Ali Soufan, a former top terrorism investigator for the FBI. The details of Omar Mateen's phone call with 911, in which he reportedly declared allegiance to ISIS, have not been released to the public. But other details suggest he had only a superficial knowledge of ISIS and what it stood for. Law enforcement officials say he had previously espoused admiration for Al-Qaeda and Hezbollah, even though the latter, a Shia militant group based in Lebanon, is actively fighting ISIS in Syria. But ISIS's willingness to extend its brand to such a loose range of attacks is emblematic of its confused strategy for external operations. Yes, it helps them in terms of their propaganda value, but as part of a strategy, it starts to fall apart, says Watts. I don't know that on the investigative side, when you focus so heavily on the ISIS nexus, that it really helps you in terms of case building or expanding things out. In his audio recording in May, Adnani, the ISIS spokesman, specifically called for attacks in Europe and the U.S., appealing to potential recruits who might otherwise travel to join ISIS in Iraq and Syria. He appears to have thrown open the door to any would-be attacker. That approach is part of a new era of transnational jihadism, one that embraces so-called lone wolf attackers. It is also a departure from an older model, which placed more emphasis on central control and the planning of more elaborate operations, like the 9/11 attacks. In letters that became public after his killing, Osama bin Laden cautioned against the use of solo attackers and fretted over extending the Al-Qaeda brand to less disciplined groups. But even bin Laden's chosen successor, Ayman al-Zawahiri, issued a call for lone attackers last year. Soufan points out that ISIS's current laissez-faire attitude toward solo attackers is actually a reversal for the group, which previously distinguished itself from Al-Qaeda by establishing a true state in the territory it occupied in Iraq and Syria, something bin Laden's group could never do. They are trying to do exactly what they criticized Al-Qaeda for, which is going back to being a terrorist organization, an underground terrorism organization, he says. This article posted by Jared Malzin in Istanbul.
The gunman who attacked an Orlando gay nightclub, leaving 49 dead on Sunday, spoke to police by phone during the incident and told them he would strap explosives to hostages inside the building, according to the city's mayor. Orlando Mayor Buddy Dyer said Wednesday that people trapped inside the building also warned family members and 911 operators that the shooter, Omar Mateen, was threatening to use bombs and an explosive vest, the New York Times reported. Law enforcement officials have not yet found evidence of any explosives in the building, according to the Times. We had a lot of information from the inside, and they independently were saying yes, the bomber is about to put on an explosive vest, Dyer said. This article posted by Katie Riley. The police department for Oakland, California, lost its second police chief in less than a week on Wednesday amid a scandal involving allegations of statutory rape of a sex worker by multiple officers. Oakland Mayor Libby Schaaf announced the removal of interim police chief Ron Farrow on Wednesday. Schaaf had appointed Farrow to replace former chief Sean Wendt, who stepped down last week, The Guardian reported. I have just received information that has caused me to lose confidence in Ben Farrow's ability to lead the Oakland Police Department, OPD, at this particular moment in time, Schaaf said in a statement, but did not give details about the information. I made the decision to appoint Ben Farrow. I also own the decision to remove him. I firmly believe that when you make a mistake, you need to own it and act quickly to correct it. The leadership shakeup comes after a few high-profile scandals have plagued the department and raised questions about widespread misconduct in the city's police force. The sexual misconduct scandal follows accusations that late Officer Brendan O'Brien killed his wife in 2014 and got away with it. O'Brien left a suicide note last year that led to investigations into sexual misconduct in the department. This article posted by Katie Riley.
Democratic senators filibuster for gun control. Connecticut Senator Chris Murphy led a group of his Democratic colleagues in a filibuster Wednesday morning in an attempt to force votes on two gun control measures in the wake of the Orlando shooting. Murphy is seeking up and down votes on two bipartisan measures. One would ban those on the FBI's terrorism watch list from purchasing firearms or explosives, a measure that might have prevented the weekend tragedy at a gay nightclub, the deadliest mass shooting in U.S. history, as the shooter Omar Mateen had been on the FBI watch list at one time. The second measure would close the so-called Charleston loophole in background checks, fully funding three-day background checks to ensure felons and drug users are not purchasing weapons. That bill would have prevented convicted drug user Dylan Roof from buying the gun he allegedly used to shoot 9 people to death in a Charleston church a year ago Friday. While both measures have enjoyed bipartisan support, the powerful gun lobby has succeeded in blocking votes and passage of both for years. On Monday, sponsor Representative Peter King, a New York Republican, told Time that despite the horrific event in Florida, he remained unhopeful that either could pass the lower chamber. The Senate filibuster could change that political calculus if enough momentum and outrage builds to pass the measures through the Senate. Republican leaders, in response to a query on the filibuster, noted that Texas Senator John Cornyn, the number two Republican, is working on a GOP measure banning those on the terrorism watch list from buying weapons. And gun control groups have been working with Senator Pat Toomey, a Pennsylvania Republican, who led the failed bipartisan effort to pass gun control in the wake of the Newtown school shooting, to get some form of these provisions through. I'm going to remain on this floor until we get some signal, some sign that we can come together on these two measures, that we can get a path forward on addressing this epidemic in a meaningful, bipartisan way, said Murphy, who has been a strong advocate of gun control after the Sandy Hook shooting left 20 children between the ages of 6 and 7 dead in 2012. Newtown is still putting itself back together, probably will be for a long time, and Orlando the same. And so our hearts break for what that community is going through. Democratic Senators Richard Blumenthal, a former Connecticut Attorney General, and Cory Booker, the former mayor of Newark, accompanied Murphy's filibuster on the floor. Other Democrats, such as Illinois' Dick Durbin, have also come to the floor to voice support, and more are expected throughout the day. I've cleared my entire day, Booker said. I've cleared my evening events so that I can stay on this floor and support Senator Murphy. The Senate had been debating a bill funding the Justice Department for fiscal 2017. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell had not filed for cloture on that measure, limiting the number of hours of debate, which means Murphy and his crew could theoretically talk indefinitely. This article posted by J. Newton Small.
The U.S. economic recovery is so fragile right now that it cannot sustain another headwind. That's essentially what the Federal Reserve said when it voted Wednesday to leave short-term interest rates at their historically low levels in a move that was widely expected. A rate hike was extremely unlikely this month, given the sharp decline in job creation in May, weak domestic economic growth, and continued worries over events abroad. That includes a June 23rd referendum in Great Britain that could have England leaving the European Union, a move that is likely to raise a host of new uncertainties about the global economy. The Fed's decision to remain on hold, in theory, should keep the value of the U.S. dollar from rising, as low yields generally deter investors from parking their cash in a particular currency. And a flat or falling dollar is generally bullish for large U.S. companies whose foreign sales are hurt whenever the dollar rises. Yet the equation could change if Brits vote to leave the European Union, potentially creating chaos that could force international investors to flee the euro for the safer harbor of the dollar. But that's for later. For now, the Fed's commitment to ultra-low rates should keep the sluggish but advancing recovery going forward as the current business cycle is lumbering into the start of its eighth year. The focus now quickly turns to when the Fed might raise rates next. We think the Fed raises only one time this year, says John Stoltzfus, chief investment strategist for Oppenheimer Asset Management. We'd be surprised if the Fed raises twice. But will that be in late July when the central bank meets next, or late September? Or will we have to wait until early November? You've heard this story before. For the past few years, the central bank has been full of Hamlet on the Potomac equivocations, with Fed officials hinting they'd like to increase rates from near historic lows, only to back away because of weak data or a global crisis just before a meeting. Except for last December, when the Fed raised rates ever so slightly, from near zero to a range of between 0.25% and 0.5%, something always seems to get in the way. Here's a look at where the economy really stands and what challenges remain. The headwinds. The Fed has two priorities: to keep inflation steady and maximize employment. The past two jobs reports show there is still much work to be done on the latter. Employers added only 38,000 jobs in May, following 123,000 in April. Compare that to 271,000 new workers added last December. Wages, meanwhile, still linger below pre-recession levels, only picking up 2.5% over the past 12 months, while inflation continues to rise below the Fed's 2% target. The labor force participation rate has also ticked down in recent months, and the economic growth disappointed in the first 3 months of the year, gaining only 0.8%. The bond market reflects a rather bleak outlook. The 10-year Treasury securities now pay just 1.61%, about half the yield from early 2014 levels. The appetite for bonds, which are coveted in a slow-growing environment free of inflation, seems insatiable. Bond yields have an inverse relationship to bond prices. In fact, this is the lowest point for borrowing rates in the past 5 years, according to Bank of America Merrill Lynch. The tailwinds. There's still reason for optimism. The unemployment rate rests at only 4.7%. Household spending is strong, and oil has rebounded off of recent lows. Retail sales grew more than expected in May after outperforming in April and have gained 2.5% over the past year. Core retail sales, which strips out cars, gasoline, building materials, and food services, also proved strong, leading economists to believe that economic growth will pick up in the second 3 months of 2016. Overall, real GDP growth appears to have picked up to about a 2% pace in the second quarter, following a 0.8% gain, notes J.P. Morgan Fund's chief global strategist, David Kelly. If next month's jobs data improve and there's no severe exogenous shock, the Fed will have to seriously consider raising rates in July, at least from a credibility standpoint, says co-portfolio manager of the BMO TCH Core Plus Bond Fund, Scott Kimball. The verdict. All else being equal, the Fed seems inclined to increase rates. Stanley Fischer, the Fed's vice chair, started off the year by saying we could see 3 or 4 hikes this year, and you often hear Fed officials say something vaguely hawkish during press conferences and interviews. But it looks as if the labor market has miles to go before investors will see another increase. My view is that the U.S. economy will continue to expand in the coming quarters, noted Russ Kosterich, head of asset allocation for BlackRock's Global Allocation Fund. Just don't expect great things or consistency. This article posted by Taylor Tepper. Tucked in the middle of Apple's WWDC presentation this week was a series of updates meant to bolster Apple's smart home efforts, which revolve around software called HomeKit. But over the past year, a triad of market forces, Apple's goals, competition from rivals like Amazon and Google, and consumers' needs, have been pushing the smart home around like a Ouija's planchette. So what is the future of the smart home? As with the Ouija, the answer may depend on who pushes the hardest. Apple's biggest announcement around smart home technology was the unveiling of a new Home app to be included in a forthcoming iPhone update, a control center linking together all of a user's HomeKit-compatible devices. Home's capabilities had previously been sprinkled around between the iOS settings screen and individual devices' apps. That approach was anything but smart. Imagine, for example, that you bought 2 different kinds of HomeKit-compatible smart light bulbs for your living room. Outside of using Siri, more on that later, you would have to use 2 different apps to turn your lights on or off. 2 apps, 1 unnecessary complication. Also, some of the apps were dreadful. But Apple's new Home app should let you turn down your thermostat in the same place you turn on your lights. It's a step in the right direction, especially when programming what Apple calls scenes or favorite settings for given devices and given situations. Dimming the lights for movie night, say. In fact, it's remarkable people like me tried to embrace the smart home before a solution like this existed. One caveat. The new Home app looks like it relies heavily on Apple's pressure-sensitive 3D touch technology for its user interface. That feature is only found on newer iPhones, so owners of older models may want to prepare for some frustration. This design choice may give a tactile feel to the processes of turning up and down the heat, but it may also turn off smart home owners because of the $649 upgrade cost is a steep price to pay for what is effectively a light switch. Of course, it's entirely possible that Apple will engineer ways for older phones to play house. Still, anyone with an iPhone can use Apple's Siri voice assistant to control HomeKit-compatible gear. This is where Apple has wisely planted its smart home flag. According to a recent voice assistant study by MindMeld, 45% of surveyed users just started using interfaces like Siri in the past year, and 43% use them at home the most. Apple figures that people carry their phones around with them wherever they go, and the voice assistant's "Hey Siri" command is suitable for triggering home devices. But as a regular Siri user and smart home owner, my experience has not proven this true. Sometimes my iPhone doesn't recognize my "Hey Siri" calls, and it's not a microphone problem, it's a software one. If I wake the phone with the sleep wake button, it suddenly starts to hear me. Also, the iPhone's ears have proven an ill match for the Amazon Echo's 7-mic array. The smart speaker's microphones seem to hear me even if I just think of calling Echo's name, all while playing blaring rock music. That said, Apple has a Trojan horse in the battle over the smart home, Apple TV. The new Apple TV's Siri remote will soon also be able to interact with HomeKit devices, so you'll be able to use your clicker to turn your gear on or off. Looking ahead, it's going to be a bloody battle for smart home dominance between these two devices this holiday season. Google, too, recently announced an Echo-like device called Google Home. Apple TV starts at $149, and Amazon Echo currently costs $179. There will be sales. Another thing Echo has going for it is that its open ecosystem encourages development. That means any gadget you buy could possibly be supported by Alexa. By comparison, Apple's HomeKit has required developers to install made-for-iOS chips in their products. The result is a safer, more secure device, which homeowners love, of course, but component delays have made it harder to get third-party Apple-compatible gadgets on store shelves. Apple's relaunch of HomeKit seems to acknowledge that those manufacturing bottlenecks are coming to an end. Now that more products are coming to market, Apple is intent getting the smart home right. Will it happen? Only a few minutes of the WWDC keynote's 2-hour presentation touched on HomeKit, so I'm not leaving the light on for it. This article posted by John Patrick Pullen.
Thanks for joining us. I'm Harvey Kojan, and you've been listening to the daily edition of Times the Brief. To get this sent to your inbox every morning, go to time.com/thebrief. You can also subscribe through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. I'll be back tomorrow. Until then, enjoy the day.